We'll now have the announcements.
The Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by studying otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. The announcements. The Philadelphia Lodge has 3 weekly meetings in order to disseminate the theosophical ideas found in the Declaration. The Sunday meeting begins at 11 and ends at 12 noon. Last Sunday, we completed studies in Crosby's Universal Theosophy with the article, The Storehouse of Thought. This month, we will begin a new umbrella theme, as we do each month during the fall and winter. The theme for October is Theosophy and the Theosophical Movement. Some aspect of this theme will be presented each Sunday in a forum, lecture talk, or panel discussion. Today's lecture is The Origin of the Esoteric Philosophy. And next Sunday, the panel discussion is entitled Theosophy Synthesizes Science and Religion. Last Wednesday, we completed the last chapter in the Bhagavad Gita, studying the topic of supreme happiness. This Wednesday, October 6, we will resume our study of The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. We will be studying Chapter 1 and focusing on the broad theme of masters, perfected human beings. The focus will be, do they help mankind? For the next 2 Wednesdays, the same umbrella theme, masters, perfected human beings, will be studied from the perspective of historical traces and from the perspective of the power and influence of these perfected beings. The Friday evening roundtable discussion group meets from 6:30 until 7:30. This summer, we discussed a series of articles by William Q. Judge, culminating with the topic of universal brotherhood, a fact in nature. Last Friday, we began a new study in the Echoes from the Orient by William Q. Judge. Section 1. This Friday, we will continue and will discuss section 2. In all the meetings, participants are encouraged to address comments to the chair rather than to each other in order to continue to foster an atmosphere of anonymity and impersonality. All of the lodges are united through the principles contained in the Declaration. Yet each lodge is free to determine how to best disseminate these ideas wherever located in the world. Also, all theosophical work is done by volunteers who, through the giving of their time and resources, keep these ideas available for others, just as others kept them available for us. If interested in volunteering, please get in touch with one of the lodges. Help is always appreciated. The materials mentioned this morning may be purchased from many of the lodges, also from Theosophy Company in Los Angeles, California, or downloaded from the Phoenix, Arizona Lodge website. Podcasts of these meetings may be heard at the Philadelphia Lodge website. And that concludes the general announcements. Next, there will be a spiritual reading, which will be followed by today's lecture talk. This reading is from the rendition by William Q. Judge of the Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 4, Devotion Through Spiritual Knowledge. Krishna is speaking. This exhaustless doctrine of yoga I formerly taught unto Vivaswat. Vivaswat communicated it to Manu, and Manu made it known unto Ikshwaku, and being thus transmitted from one unto another, it was studied by the Rajarshis, until at length in the course of time the mighty art was lost, O harasser of thy foes. It is even the same exhaustless, secret, eternal doctrine I have this day communicated unto thee, because thou art my devotee and my friend. Arjuna. Seeing that thy birth is posterior to the life of Ikshwaku, how am I to understand that thou wert in the beginning the teacher of this doctrine? Krishna. Both I and thou have passed through many births, O harasser of thy foes. Mine are known unto me, but thou knowest not of thine. Even though myself unborn of changeless essence and the Lord of all existence, yet in presiding over nature, which is mine, I am born but through my own Maya, the mystic power of self-ideation, the eternal thought and the eternal mind. I produce myself among creatures, O son of Bharata, whenever there is a decline of virtue and an insurrection of vice and injustice in the world. And thus I incarnate from age to age, for the preservation of the just, the destruction of the wicked, and the establishment of righteousness. Again, the talk for today is the origin of esoteric philosophy.
Friends are subject of the over embracing umbrella theme for October is Theosophy and the Theosophical Movement. So it is fitting that we begin with a consideration of the origin of the esoteric philosophy. H.P. Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine as well as the modern theosophical movement, has made the contribution to world thought publicly that there has always existed a body of knowledge which embraces laws operating in every department of nature, not just great nature, the cosmos, but human nature. And this body of knowledge includes the divine, the spiritual, the invisible departments, as well as the physical, visible, and material ones. So we could say it includes material life, our mental life, our moral life, our psychic life, and our spiritual life, but not just for humanity, but for all human beings, all beings, and great nature. In a nutshell, then, this body of knowledge is wisdom about the presence and manifestation and influence of the unknown and unknowable divine essence in every department of nature, in every human being, the complete knowledge as most as can be fathomed by the human mind. Now, it has had many terms. We have heard the term used, the ancient wisdom religion. And very often we see that that term has been used when the emphasis is on making the point that this body of knowledge is both scientific and religious, and that it has existed from the dawn of thinking humanity on this planet. Now, another term we have used and heard of quite frequently, of course, is theosophy, theosophia, which is a Greek word that means divine wisdom or wisdom of the gods. And when this term is used, the primary emphasis is to make the point that this body of knowledge is a synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy, which has been preserved and is known by wise human beings down through the ages. Now, although this body of knowledge has had many different names, varying in expression and terminology in every nation or civilization, one aspect seems to remain the same. And that is, while portions of this body of knowledge have been publicly expressed, the entirety of the wisdom is esoteric, hidden, secret. And we learn that throughout the ages, it has been known by the initiates in this wisdom of every nation and civilization. When H.P. Blavatsky published The Secret Doctrine, she referred to this secret wisdom as the esoteric philosophy. And while we have esoteric or hidden aspects of Judaism, of Christianity, of Hinduism, of Buddhism, of Islam, she demonstrates that there is enough known about the inner esoteric aspects of these great religious philosophies of the ancient and modern world to recognize that they all have a common origin, even though their expression and their emphasis may vary. So the esoteric philosophy, the term, is that hidden secret wisdom, which is the one source of every science and every philosophical, ethical religion in the world, ancient, modern, Eastern, Western. And to quote her in The Secret Doctrine, she says, "The records we mean to place before the reader embrace the esoteric tenets of the whole world since the beginning of our humanity." And in another source, in an article she called "What is Theosophy?" she says, "Theosophy is then the archaic wisdom religion, the esoteric doctrine once known in every ancient country having claims to civilization." So if we understand that there's this esoteric philosophy or hidden line of teaching that is the source of all great religions and philosophies in their outer and inner, their esoteric and exoteric aspects, we may ask then, well, what is the origin of the esoteric philosophy itself? Is there some point in time or some place where it first began or arose? Is there some method or means from which it was derived? Is there some person or persons who were responsible for its initial formulation? And it's a fair series of questions, but we want to keep in mind a few basic ideas. One is, while most of the religions we're familiar with are attributed in their origin to the teachings and influence of one human being, the same cannot be said of the origin of the esoteric philosophy. While many religions initially arose at a specific time, coming to a specific nation, the same cannot be said of the esoteric philosophy. And while most philosophical systems we're familiar with, whether they be ancient or modern, Eastern or Western, are derived from specific philosophical schools of thinkers and emphasize the particular speculations and approach of those thinkers, the same cannot be said of the esoteric philosophy, its origin. While most scientific theories are derived from an experimental method which tests and verifies the laws operating on the physical plane in the operations of substance with the use of physical senses and instruments, the same cannot be said of the origin of the scientific aspects of the esoteric philosophy. So having said all that, we can say, perhaps once again in a nutshell, the esoteric philosophy is the accumulated wisdom of the ages. It is not the property of any one nation or race or philosophical school or individual divine revelation. So there are three ways this morning as to how we will consider the origin of the esoteric philosophy. First, we have in The Secret Doctrine what is expressed to us as the first item. And in this series of paragraphs, we're introduced to the idea of adepts, human beings who have perfected their physical, psychic, mental, and spiritual natures to the highest degree. not just their intellect, but their inner faculties and senses, so that they can look directly into the heart of nature and witness and record and check and verify the operations of laws operating on those planes, which would ordinarily be invisible, unknown, and hidden from the untrained individual. So obviously, this takes a long time to perfect and develop those faculties. But then, having developed those faculties, they spent their lives in learning before teaching and promulgating and disseminating these ideas. What did they do? Well, there have been oral traditions passed on for many generations of wise beings from what is called in theosophy the third and fourth root races, or those portions of humanity that developed on the third and fourth kind, Lemuria and Atlantis, we have in the tradition. And when the continent or series of continents that made up this civilization, the fourth root race, Atlantis, was destroyed, the survivors, the adepts, spent their lives in checking, testing, verifying the oral traditions of old, looking into the very heart of nature. But no one finding or conclusion by one adept was accepted until it was checked, tested, and verified by other seers and adepts. And this went on for generations until, over time, there was a body of accumulated wisdom, which could be recorded in writing and in symbols so that it could continuously be checked and tested and verified by the next generation of adepts. And so we have, in the course of time, this knowledge preserved throughout time. And it is said that at the time of the destruction of the last islands of Atlantis some 10,000 years ago, mystery schools were established by adepts so that individuals who felt themselves yearning for this knowledge and willing to go through the discipline and training necessary could have access to these teachings. And at the same time, these mystery schools provided a public service by presenting to the general masses in the form of symbols, myths, legends, plays, stories, all sorts of means by which the fundamental universal ideas regarding the soul, its life, its progress, could be kept alive in the public and mind of the masses. Now, HPB tells us that she was a disciple of this lodge of adepts, and that she recorded in the secret doctrine all that could be given out to the present generation of inquirers and interested persons around the world, regardless of their race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, all that could be given out publicly. That there was much more, but this would be the most complete public presentation of these ancient ideas up until this point. So we might say that we can trace the origin of theosophy, or the esoteric philosophy and its written, recorded form, at least back to the beginning of the fifth root race after the destruction of Atlantis. And that was a long time ago. But when did the esoteric philosophy originate on this earth? Because we have indicated that there were races and progress of civilization before the Atlanteans or the fourth root race. So when did the esoteric philosophy originate on this earth? How did it originate? Where did it originate? In the teachings, we have given to us the idea that humanity goes through successive rounds or periods of evolution. And this involves evolution of the physical, the psychic, the mental nature. And it was during the third root race, or the third stage of development on this earth, in this round period of evolution, some 18 million years ago, that humanity had finally evolved to the point where it had developed the vehicle which was appropriate for the incarnation of the mind or thinking principle. And having acquired mind, it was endowed with self-consciousness and spiritual perception. It was at this point that mind beings who had acquired mind in previous periods of evolution, long before this earth and series of Earth's globes began, incarnated to teach and instruct those awakened minds who were interested, who hungered for this spiritual knowledge, while at the same time impacting in the human nature in general those innate ideas of the spiritual realm, the spiritual reality, which could be carried along through the ages. And it is from those mind beings awakened and instructed by these initiators in the early infancy of humanity that we have developing in the races, the fourth, the third race, adepts, a nursery of adepts. And it is they and their disciples who carried through for many, many countless generations these oral traditions. They became a living tree of adepts, a tribe of ancient heroes that taught the arts and sciences to humanity and governed as divine dynasty and divine kings. They preserved this wisdom orally and passed it down to their initiated disciples. And we see this tale repeated over and over again in the Americas, in the East, in all the ancient civilizations. So we might say that the origin of theosophy or the ancient wisdom religion or the esoteric philosophy has a spiritual origin in the sense that it was passed on from one mind to another. That wisdom was lit up in the minds of the younger souls evolving towards knowledge. And so we have with us the term enlightenment, referring to that awakening, that enlightenment of the mind that comes from such spiritual realization. The perfection of that we find in many different cultures. We know of the term Christos or Buddha, all referring to that highest state of spiritual illumination. So it comes to us then that the esoteric philosophy, the hidden secret wisdom, is not primarily of this earth. Although there was a time when it was first transmitted to human beings, although there was a time when it was first recorded for human beings, although there was a time not too long ago in the 1800s when the most complete public expression was put forth for the nations of the world to consider in the secret doctrine. Although there was a specific time it manifested on earth, it is ultimately of a spiritual nature and origin. How is that? Well, we remember in our reading of the Bhagavad Gita today that Krishna is speaking as that universal divine essence that periodically manifests throughout nature. It says, I produce this world, I produce this, all these beings through the divine thought in the divine mind, the mystic power of self-ideation, the eternal thought in the eternal mind. So we might say that there's a plan, there is an intelligence that overrides and influences the entire universe and all human beings. And since it is in the realm of ideation, if we can raise our minds, our power of thought and perception to that level, if we can get our minds away from the narrow, limited perceptions of the senses, of ourselves as separate personalities, of our passions, and begin to direct it in a more disciplined way to universal ideas, to spiritual truths, more and more our minds become permeated with this divine wisdom. And we might say then, this divine wisdom is esoteric or hidden or secret from the mind that is not so initiated or prepared. Just as the sun is always shining, but its rays, its heat, its light can be clouded over by the clouds or the atmosphere, which don't allow it to come through. And in our case, the cloudy atmosphere is produced by the very thoughts and feelings that we have. If we can elevate those thoughts and feelings, clear them up, that divine radiance, that divine wisdom, that theosophia, wisdom of the gods, that eternal thought in the eternal mind can come through directly to us as self-knowledge. So while there is a recorded teaching for us, it is also said that true self-knowledge, true knowledge of the esoteric philosophy, the hidden wisdom, is not just a matter of the intellect. It's also a matter of the awakened intuition. Not just a matter of the doctrine of the eye, but a doctrine of the heart. And if we live the life indicated, then we will know the doctrine. Not because we read it somewhere, not because we heard it in a lecture, but because our minds have become open, our nature has become attuned to the highest spiritual aspect of our nature, which is one with that absolute source. And in that divine nature where all this wisdom is recorded and impacted and wells, once we rise to that, we partake of it and can share it with others. And that has been the aspiration of all the initiates, of all the adepts and of all those who have strived to reach that condition in order to gain that knowledge so that they can pass it on to others, just as others made the effort in previous times and were able to pass it on to us. So these then are a few of the essential ideas were given as to the origin of the esoteric philosophy. Remembering that it is once a synthesis of science and religion, which we will discuss next week, recognizing that it is knowledge that can be known and that there are the knowers of it, and also that while it is hidden from our view, it is not impossible. In fact, it is probable that every individual who makes the effort in time will be able to know that wisdom firsthand for themselves and through themselves. So we'll stop here and open the meeting to your questions and comments. MDW.
Yes. Very interesting ideas. What are we to do? What are we to do? It says somewhere we've read that the royal talisman is duty. So, with all that you have just brought to our attention, what is our duty?
What is our duty? One of the ideas that comes out as a fundamental teaching of the esoteric philosophy, and we'll have more of this in the weeks to come, is the idea that all human beings are self-conscious souls in evolution. So they have two purposes in the course of their evolution as souls. One is to purify, to uplift, to enlighten their faculties of perception, their senses, their intellect, their intuitions, so that they can become more a vehicle, more in tune with that divine thought in the divine mind. Make themselves more like that divine essence from which they come. So that is one duty we have, to work on ourselves. But the other duty we have is to lift up, raise the intelligence in all the kingdoms below us, as well as our fellow human beings, recognizing that there's a degree of soul consciousness intelligence evolving all the time and everywhere. So that means we have a duty to nature, we have a duty to this planet, we have a duty to the kingdoms, we have a duty to other human beings. We have a duty to the nations, to our nations, to our families, and to ourselves. How do we know where to begin? We come to the duties we need to face under law. So we find under law, the law of cause and effect, in our everyday lives, in the personal nature we have acquired, in the particular responsibility we have to our nation, to our family, to our community, those opportunities to apply this wisdom or whatever wisdom we have acquired so far to uplift, to elevate, to lighten the suffering of those around us. We do have a chat that came in. The royal talisman is duty, makes sense. We need to fulfill our duties in order to exhaust our karma so that we can reincarnate and learn to evolve enough to purify ourselves so we can become gurus or guides someday. The same idea previously mentioned, expressed in very concisely, that we exhaust our karma by facing the everyday duties that come to us under karma, under law. And having done that, in the process of reincarnation, we will face new opportunities, further opportunities to refine our nature and further opportunities to influence nature in a greater degree. TK, you had your hand up. Did you have your hand up, TK?
It was said by the chair that there's overriding intelligence or overriding plan in the entire universe on the plane of ideation. And if we directly, I think the words were like, to direct our minds in a disciplined way, then they can become, we can become more permeated by these high ideals and live them out. So the key there then, what does it mean if we direct our minds toward it in a disciplined way? What is it?
To direct our mind towards it?
It sounds like there's a practice.
It sounds like there's a discipline or a practice. So as mind beings, once we incarnate, we not only have our inherent spiritual nature as thinking beings which incarnate from life to life, but we have that aspect of our mind which becomes fully involved with the conditions of the world and the body we've incarnated into. And that's a very important part of the whole process of evolution, because it is by incarnating into this world of various conditions and possibilities that we gain that further experience, which is increases our wisdom about life and our interconnectedness with it. And also it is that connection with conditional life that gives us the opportunity to uplift, to raise, to influence those around us. So as we incarnate, we say we have two aspects of the mind. One, our lower mind is continuously influenced and pulled in direction by our sensations, by our desires, by our identity with ourselves and limited personalities. And there is that aspect of our mind which still senses that there is something more, something real, something that transcends the material life. And one does not have to be a student of theosophy to feel the reality of this and practice it in their lives and help other people. We know people of all different religious traditions who, either through personal suffering or prompt and the right teaching, have come to realize that as much as there is of suffering in the life, as much as there is in the material world to distract us and pull us down, there is also that divine presence of spirit. And with that comes the knowledge, with that spiritual illumination that comes directly to those souls, comes to the realization that a part of themselves, a part of them life, their life is more important, transcends, and has to be expressed and control the physical world in spite of all the challenges. They can't put a label on it. They can't describe it philosophically, but they know it is real. And because of that, they have that divine idea, the power to live more life, good human beings, and help others. So that is the kind of discipline that we want to develop more and more, to make our minds more aware of the spiritual reality of life, the enduring influence and power of our higher nature and the powers it has and how it can control not just our own instruments, but how it can be useful in the affairs of everyday life. And that's a discipline, is it not? That's a practice. And we actually see that kind of discipline in all religions, because all religions speak of this duality and this conflict between the higher and the lower part of human nature. They give it different terminology, and there's different stories about it, but that's, in essence, is the path of the devotee in any true religion, to try to make the real, the divine, the spiritual, the godly, if you will, more present in this world. MJW.
So it's interesting that the word presence and present, although spelled differently, are in ways many similar, are similar. And that our presence, our being fully there for others, is really a present in a sense. And it's the way, if we present ourselves as being fully present, then our presence, the two of us, like if it's one-on-one especially, because it's a transcendent experience. If we're fully there for another, and we feel that gets really, you know, and it's something to try to practice. In a sense, it's hard to maintain, but perhaps that should be our focus all the time.
It's interesting how many meanings we can have to a word. And as you said, this idea of being present, being present means being totally focused in the here and now, the present, as opposed to having our minds dwelling on the past and future, but in the now and present for others, performing our duties for others, which in a way is another kind of present, because that's a gift. It's a present we give to another human being. And so that's all that is wrapped up in that idea of the presence. And when we think of that, that's esoteric. That's hidden. That present, I mean, there's presents we can get. We can wrap up gifts. We can give each other books and candy and shirts and ties. But the present of our presence is totally esoteric and hidden. It cannot be weighed, measured, or sensed by the senses. And yet its impact is not only real to us, it has a real and direct impact on others. MDW. MDW? No? Okay. Follow up, MJW?
Well, we had a thought that, is anything in writing truly esoteric? That's all.
Is anything in writing truly esoteric? Well, all language, all writing is a symbol. And therefore, it's a representation for what the reality is behind. Now, there are certain languages that are better than others for expressing that which is not orderly able to be expressed. For example, we know the language of music, which is a universal language that can convey emotional states to people all over the world, regardless of their knowledge of a language, whereas if you try to express an emotional condition in a written language to someone who didn't understand that language, they may not understand what you're talking. They may not realize that you're talking about suffering or joy, but they can hear music and that can convey it. So language itself has its limitations. Now, there is a language or a series of symbols which is as secret and mysterious as the esoteric philosophy itself, which is the language of the adepts. It's called the sensar language. And we can read about that in the Secret Doctrine. And perhaps this language is the closest one that the human mind can evolve to express these universal truths for the soul. But the soul speaks to us in the language of symbolism, and we get that through our own direct perception in dreams, in visions, and so we have our own inner language. So once something is written down, it's no longer esoteric or hidden. Now, the recording of it can be hidden away in libraries, in crypts, so it's not generally available to the public. In that sense, it's esoteric. But once something is written down, whether it becomes exoteric by its nature, and especially once something has been presented to the public, it's no longer esoteric. It now becomes part of the exoteric or the expressed part of our knowledge. And so that's the point of the secret doctrine. It's an attempt to put down in the English language those teachings which had been recorded and kept private and kept secret, or those teachings which could not be expressed openly for the first time in a language that was, for all intents and purposes, the most universal. And since then, we know that the secret doctrine has been translated into many other languages, but it was an attempt to make that which was esoteric or hidden now exoteric, available to the public, at least in some of its basic teachings. MDW.
So are we talking about ideas like the sevenfold nature of man and of the universe and of planets and reincarnation and karma? Are these esoteric truths that have been made exoteric?
Well, certainly ideas such as reincarnation and karma were not presented for the first time in the secret doctrine or with the formation of the Theosophical Society or other aspects of the modern theosophical movement. We know that these ideas have been part of the public expression and teaching of religions in the East and in some aspects in the West for many generations. But what is esoteric about it is how it, as was suggested, plays out in the drama of human evolution, not only in the various principles we have, but also in our evolution on this planet and the interconnection between our development through reincarnation and karma as human beings and the development of the planet, the world in which we live around us. So these interconnections have been made public or put before the mind to consider for the first time. But the general teaching of reincarnation and karma is something that's been public and for many generations. And it's probably one of those innate ideas, because even children have a sense of justice, of fairness, of when they're being treated properly. They have a sense of when something is too severe for the punishment, the punishment is too severe or unjust or unfair. And they also have a sense of their immortality, some even a sense that they lived before. In certain cultures, that's encouraged. In certain cultures, that dies away. But the idea that we are soul beings, that we are more than this physical expression, is one of those innate ideas that we see around the world in all times. MJW.
It is interesting being around children, and yes, they do have a sense of justice and an innate sense of justice. And it's interesting when the punishment does not fit the crime, as it were, or seemingly so, then a lot of resentment and feelings of wanting to lash out against those who meted out the punishment. But that's one of our tests, is to be able to transcend that. And it takes, we think, many lifetimes probably, but to be able to transcend that and to love those that hate us, in a sense. Not that the person who punished us hates us, but if you look at karma and reincarnation, those two missing links that generally are not emphasized, or at least in the past haven't been in the Western world, then the puzzle starts to come together, and it's like, we need to transcend that. And that's a real challenge. But so many people, they think this isn't fair. Why is this happening to me? And it really, the world does seem unjust and unfair. But that's because we only have a little bit of knowledge or part of the picture.
Well, it's only one of the many contradictions and challenges of life, of existing in the physical world. The experience of death, grief, for the loss of a loved one is a universal experience. And yet, how many can experience that grief while at the same time holding on to the love that they cherish for that human being? How many people can remember and cherish and honor the love for the human being and the value of their living, as well as experience the grief of their loss? It's the same way. The experience of conflict, struggle, opposition, enmity is a common experience, a universal experience in life. And yet, how many of us, while experiencing that and acknowledging its presence, can at the main time hold on to the reality of spiritual wisdom, the realization that we are all one, we're all from the same source, and find a way in the midst of all that suffering and that loss and all that conflict to maintain our stance as spiritual divine beings and have compassion and understanding even for those that would oppress us. And we see that. We say that's a theosophical idea, and it is, because it represents divine truth, hidden wisdom, esoteric philosophy, if you will. But it is a principle that it's found in all the great philosophies and religions around the world. Any particular one that has been particularly valuable to the human experience. So we'll stop here. We did want to remind you of our Friday meeting coming up, on which we will be taking up section 2 of the Echoes of the Orient. And we are beginning our study in the Ocean of Theosophy this Wednesday on the idea of the masters and the adepts, what theosophy is. And next Sunday, continuing on this theme of theosophy and the theosophical movement, we'll have a look at theosophy as the synthesis of science and religion. Thank you, and our meeting is adjourned.